This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
In his infinite wisdom, David Wallace has authorized us to put on a little presentation about the history of Dunder Mifflin.
Yep. Old comedy team is back together again.
That's right.
Have you heard the news?
X-ray, read all about it. Newspapers for sale.
That's Steve Carell and my guest Amy Ryan in a scene from the NBC series The Office. Ryan played Holly Flax, a human resources officer who may very well be Michael Scott's soulmate, although they're no longer together. You may also know Ryan from another great TV series, HBO's The Wire. She played Port Officer Beattie Russell. Ryan received a Best Supporting Actress Oscar nomination for her role in the 2007 film Gone Baby Gone, and Tony Award nominations for her performances in Uncle Vanya and A Streetcar Named Desire. Ryan co-stars in the new film Green Zone, which opens tomorrow. It's directed by Paul Greengrass, who directed the Bourne movies. Green Zone is a thriller set in Iraq after the invasion. Matt Damon plays an army officer leading a team searching for weapons of mass destruction. Each site he's been told will have WMD has ended up having nothing, so he's growing suspicious of the secret source giving the information. Amy Ryan plays a Wall Street Journal correspondent who reported that there were WMD in Iraq, but she's growing skeptical of her source. In this scene, Damon has just met with a CIA officer who's also skeptical about the WMD claims. They talked poolside in the protected green zone where they were seen by Amy Ryan. She introduces herself to Damon.
You're in the 85th. It's WMD unit, right?
How'd you know that?
It's right there on your rifle. Lori Dane, Wall Street Journal. How's it going?
You know, we haven't found yet. Hey, right. Sergeant Perry.
We'll find it. It's frustrating, right?
A little bit.
So what are you and Marty talking about?
Oh, you know, I can't talk to you about that.
Oh, come on. You come in fresh off the field to have a lemonade with Martin Brown? Something's got to be going on.
Well, you could ask him.
I'm asking you. Does it make sense to you that we're still coming up empty?
No. No, it doesn't.
Amy Ryan, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, there's all kinds of, like, technical advisors and stuntmen for the movie Green Zone, and for your part, you didn't need any of that.
I did, actually.
You
need
did?
That. Yeah, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Anne Garrels before I started this film. A friend of mine put me in touch with her, and because, you know, detail is important to me in a film or anything I do, and if anything is going to stick out like a sore thumb, I don't want to be around it. So, I spoke with Anne on the phone one day, and she went through as much as she could in the time she had, her experience, even down to the type of clothes that she would pack and what she would wear and what was in her bag and what her pad looked like and what kind of pen she had. And so, and as well as Rajiv Chandrasekharan, he was on set now and again, and he would help me out as well.
He wrote the book that the movie is very, very loosely adapted from.
Right, Imperial Life in the Emerald City.
So it's interesting that you spoke to Anne Garrels and not Judith Miller, because a lot of people will assume that part of your character is inspired by Judith Miller,
yes,
who was
certainly
misled by sources about WMD.
Right. I mean, she is probably the most famous. I mean, certainly her articles that were in the New York Times, you know, were a great source. One of the reasons we all said, well, they must be there. We must go to war. So, She's the one that came to mind, but Paul Greengrass and I, when we got on set, we thought, well, it's almost too obvious, you know, didn't want to suddenly cut my hair short with, you know, dye it dark brown with bangs and try to emulate her physically in any way. Because my character really represents a bunch of journalists who got it wrong in the press, and it could be from, you know, UK paper or American paper. It didn't really matter as much as it mattered that I represent the failures in the press on the whole.
Now, I read part of the movie was reshot.
Yes, we did a bunch of reshoots about 6 or 7 months after we first joined up, because Matt Damon had gone away to do both Invictus and The Informant. And then we joined back up in Morocco right around the election. Actually, I was in Morocco on the election. And thanks to also CGI involved in the film, you would never know. Some of the reshoots were in London and part of the other scene was shot in Morocco, and you'd never know it.
what about continuity? Like, say you gain 2 pounds, or you've cut your hair, or something's like ever so slightly changed, and it has to be consistent with how you looked months earlier.
Matt Damon did put on weight for The Informant, and in between that time, he was frantically working out and trying to get back his military look. I mean, he had quite the transformation in between. I just didn't cut my hair. That was my favorite job. I waited, we all knew we were coming back for reshoots, so I didn't want to mess with it too much I didn't want to get too involved the way he had. But, incredible crew who'd kind of keep all that intact for you. But there was a time, actually, there's a scene I have in the movie with Matt, and it's so subtle. But we did the first part of the scene. We shot Morocco the first time around. And then when the cameras turned around on him, we were in Morocco 7 months later. And then when they turned around on me, I was in London 2 weeks later. And the only difference, I mean, every hair is in place. I had this messy ponytail. Every single strand of hair is in place, except my forehead didn't have a little bit of a dewy sheen because it was colder in London. So I wasn't, as warm as I was in Morocco. But that is the only thing that I could tell, that it wasn't all continuous.
Watching the movie, I wanted to learn more about your character, the reporter. And I couldn't help but wonder if maybe there was part of your character's story that was edited out at the end.
Well, we started one of the original scripts. I mean, we tried to show a little bit of the backstory with the character of Poundstone, because how does she have this access, to these senior officials? And, there was a quick scene that just implied that they had had a romantic relationship in the past, so they were very familiar with each other. But
this is the Greg Kinnear character who
is
your
right.
misleading source about the WND.
My misleading source, exactly.
And he works for the Bush administration, and he's one of the key people in the Green Zone overseeing the occupation.
Yes. And, we like to say there's a scene where things got a little quiet in the Green Zone, and Matt Damon and I have a chat about where you come from and what brought you here, soldier, one of those scenes. And it just seemed out of place. And I think also it diminished her a bit in some way, that being the only woman in a movie, therefore there must be sex involved or some kind of romance. And we just thought there wasn't any time for that. And let's just keep the story moving forward, because it is really the story is just a thriller and a chase movie, and we had to keep that energy going forward.
Now, was it your first thriller chase movie?
Yes, it was, yeah.
What were the ups and downs of doing a thriller chase movie? And I should say you're not in the chases.
Well, the way Paul Greengrass works is sometimes we did film a lot of scenes that he wasn't sure if they would end up in the movie or not. So there would be a day where Greg and I, we were going through, we had a tour of Saddam's torture chambers. And as we're going through there, Paul says, you're going to hear some gunshot and just, just run out and follow it. Just, and Amy, just try to get the story and go. You're like, what? And so, there's a huge crew and a bunch of extras, and here come the gunshot. And it's part of it. Your heart starts pounding. I mean, it sounds like real gunshot, and you're running over real rubble. And, there's lots of military pulling up, and here comes Matt jumping out of the Humvee. And in some ways, you go back to just being a kid, the games you make up on the spot with your friends. It was kind of like that, but with a bigger budget. So that part was thrilling. I loved it. I didn't know what to expect. And I guess in terms of the downside, and I wouldn't say this is such a negative as much as you just didn't know where. I feel in some ways as an actor, you're more of a pawn across a chessboard, as opposed to a real deep character study. These characters are really just there to move the story along.
My guest is Amy Ryan, and she co-stars in the new movie Green Zone. Let's do a little retrospective of some of your work, starting with The Wire, which is where I think many people first discovered you. This is the HBO series The Wire, and you started in it in, 2003?
That's right, yes. I joined the second season of the show when the story went to the port. Mm-hmm. I played Port Police Officer Beattie Russell.
Yeah, and who's also a single mother. And in season two, while you're working at the port, you uncovered a human trafficking ring with the help of Officer Jimmy McNulty, who you ended up living with. He moved in with you eventually. And he'd had problems with drinking. But he gave that up to live with you and your children. But by season five, he was drinking again a lot. And I want to play a scene in which you go visit at the police station his former partner, Bunk, who was also frequently his drinking partner. And you ask Bunk if he thinks that Jimmy can straighten out again. And Bunk is played by Wendell Pierce. So here's the scene.
Hey.
Busy?
No. Just, Jimmy's not in yet.
I know. He's sleeping one off.
Late night, huh?
They're all like that now. Relax, I'm not looking for a snitch. I know you're his partner in crime. I don't care.
Whoa, Beatty.
I just want to know from you where this is going. I mean, you know him. You know what it is that he can and can't do.
I don't know if I could speak on that.
Look, I'm ready to put him out, okay? For me, for my kids. I mean, if in the end, if this is all there is to him, if he can't be better than this, I just want to know.
He's working this case right now. Serial killer, actually.
You are not going to try to tell me that this is about a case. Try that on some civilian.
Look, he'll get his head in a certain place. He'll take a drink. I mean, a lot of us will.
It's more than just a drink he's taking.
Well, Beatty, I can't tell you what to do.
I don't like giving up. Okay, I gotta go back to work. Thanks for letting me vent.
That's my guest, Amy Ryan, with Wendell Pierce in a scene from season five of The Wire. You're so great. How did you get the part in The Wire?
At the time, Alexa Fogel, who's casting director here in New York, she works with David Simon quite a lot, and I'd known Alexa for years. She'd been someone who really was a champion of mine since I started my career, and Alexa brought me in for it. And that was that. But I'd been a fan of the show from the first season. And it was quite surreal to join that cast, to go down to Baltimore and meet this incredible group, this company of actors. It was a real thrill.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's such an extraordinary group that worked on The Wire. How did the prep and the direction compare to other shows that you'd worked on? And you'd worked on other shows as series regulars, but also as, you know, look. You know, the guest star on various cop and other shows.
Well, I think the world of David Simon's story really does come first, no matter what. And without giving anything away, and a lot of people are new to The Wire through DVD rentals. And even it wouldn't matter which character was the most popular and on the message boards or, you know, fan write-in letters or whatever it may be. If that character had to go because the story it needed to go in that direction, they would get killed or die or something. I think David had a formula where every five episodes someone died, whether it was a main character or just a passerby on the street. We all quickly assessed that right away. I mean, we as a company were really respectful and excited by that. That story was going to drive it. And there weren't going to be any great stars that, you know, like I think other shows have the potential to spin off characters and you can become a star from that. With David, the story is always the star. And ultimately, I think that makes actors look better.
Did you feel vulnerable not ever knowing if your character was going to get killed or your character was going to be written into the next season?
No. I mean, certainly, I mean, I actually believe I signed on for maybe a 4-year contract. And season two, I was in every episode. And then season 3, 4, and 5, David told me, you know, look, I'm not going to use you as much. And it's not personal. But the real truth is I couldn't make you detective. Just that's not the way it works. You're a port police officer. If this were a network TV show, I could write one scene where, oh, yeah, Beatty went away and she passed the test. But that's not how it works. You couldn't go from port police officer to homicide detective in, you know, a hiatus break. You know, he's like, it's not going to happen. So, you know, at the time I was disappointed because I loved, you know, being a part of the show and the company. But, you know, my mother always, you know, tells me over and over something better's around the corner. Or not better, but in this case, different. And a whole bunch of other things happened in my career simply by being available.
What happened?
I was nominated for an Oscar, for one. I was nominated for a Tony, for two. Not in that order, but just variety. Variety. I mean, that's the, you know, being on a series is in some ways a double-edged sword. You know, it's great. It's great security, and certainly artistically, it can be phenomenal experience like The Wire was for me. But then you're also, you know, you're signed on for 5 years. So you just simply aren't available if other things come along.
So the Tony was for Streetcar Named Desire?
That's right. Yes.
And the Oscar nomination was for Gone Baby Gone?
That's right.
I want to play a scene from a great movie that you were in, Gone Baby Gone. And this is a crime drama based on a Dennis Lehane novel. It's directed by Ben Affleck and stars Casey Affleck, his brother.
And Dennis was also a writer, excuse me for interrupting, Dennis was also a writer on The Wire.
Oh, yes, that's right. Good point.
Yeah.
How you got the part in Gone Baby Gone?
No, it's just I hadn't actually met Dennis until I went back the fifth year, season five, rather, after I'd done I think I'd already filmed Gone Baby Gone and went back and did that final episode.
Oh, okay. So let me set up the scene and then we'll hear it. So
okay.
Casey Affleck is a private eye who sees you on TV saying that your child Amanda has been kidnapped. But you turn out, you know, he takes the case, but you turn out to be a pretty bad mother and not a very nice person. You and your boyfriend Ray have been selling drugs. And in this scene, you're being questioned by two cops. Your sister B, played by Amy Madigan, is also in the room listening. Ed Harris plays the cop who's asking most of the questions, and he wants to know what you know about a drug dealer named Cheese who was ripped off. And you've just confessed that you worked for Cheese as a mule carrying drugs and that you took tens of thousands of dollars that belonged to Cheese, and you're explaining here how that happened.
Okay.
Me and Ray had to do this run up Nashua, right?
Yeah.
We dropped 4 keys on these bikers. When we was walking back through the motel with all the money, these cops just swooped right in, went right for the bikers. And Amanda was with us, so we just pretended to be like a family. And we got in the car, took off.
You took Amanda with you?
Oh, what am I going to do, leave her in the car, B? I don't got no daycare. It's really hard being a mother. It's hard raising a family, you know? All on my own. But God made you barren, so you and know. So I understand, B, okay?
You are an abomination.
Hey.
As God is
right here.
Witness.
Right here. What happened next?
He was driving back. And Ray. Ray was like, you know, everyone's going to think the cops got the money.
You told Cheese the cops got it.
Well, you and Ray kept the money.
This whole thing is Ray's fault.
Where's the money now, Helene?
With Ray.
And where's Ray?
Chelsea.
Okay, that's Amy Ryan in a scene from the movie Gone Baby Gone. Oh, it must be so great to read lines like, it's hard being a mother, but God made you barren, so you wouldn't know.
She's got an arsenal of weapons in her vocabulary.
Did you think of when you were taking on this character? I mean, she is a really, like, tough, nasty person and a very, like, local neighborhood kind of person. Like you'd know the neighborhood she was from, I suppose.
Yes. Starting with Dennis's book, there's so much beautiful and detailed description about Helene and her thoughts, what's going on in her mind from moment to moment. So that was a great springboard. And then, you know, honestly, when we got to Boston and we're shooting in Dorchester, and this is the neighborhood in which Helene comes from, and just meeting the local people there. And it's not to say that there are Helenes on every block, but there are a few. And with any part, I try to humanize them as much as she is a monster. But There is a reason she ended up in this situation. There's a moment where she was the child born to a similar mother. And how do you break this cycle? And where does it start? Where does it end? And try to think of it from her point of view. Certainly, I don't condone her behavior, but I could understand it. You know, even that moment she says to B, what am I going to do, leave her in the car? That is her best parenting. You know, I'm happy to know I'm a better parent than she is.
Oh, I hope so.
But, that's what she knows. And so with any part, it's trying not to judge the character as much as just be them.
What about the Boston accent, very neighborhood Boston accent? How did you do it without overdoing it?
Well, every moment, you know, every time there's a break on set, you know, lots of actors go check their phone or messages, or you go over to the craft service and you get a snack. I would sit with every teamster possible and who were from the area and just talk to them. How was your weekend? What'd you get up to? And keep that sound going constantly with me. And then I had the good fortune of my director, Ben Affleck, and the star of the movie, Casey Affleck, were helping me along the way. They would just say, I don't even know if I can do it anymore, but they said, it's not Mada, or I can't do it. But they would keep me on my toes there. And also the young woman who played my best friend in the movie, Jill Quigg, is, she was a non-actor. She's an actor now, but Ben discovered her just literally on the street.
I'm so glad you say that, because she seemed like a non-actor. There just seemed to be something just like so authentically who she was in the movie.
Yeah, she actually broke through. There's a story. My first day of shooting, I couldn't get onto set. They called for me, and I walked over from my trailer, and there were a lot of neighbors out watching filming, and there was a little police barricade set up, asking them to stand behind, and I had to walk through that, and I couldn't get on set. One of the production assistants thought I was a neighbor just trying to meet Ben Affleck. And I tried out the Boston accent. I was like, no, I'm in the movie. He says, no, just stand there. So I was late 20 minutes until a producer finally recognized me. She got me through the barricade. But Jill Quigg, watching filming one day, broke through the barrier, no problem, went right up to Ben Affleck and demanded a part in the movie, basically.
How did she break through? What was her thing?
She's her savvy. That's her survival skill in that neighborhood. So,
and what did Ben Affleck recognize in her?
Authenticity. Ben had said before we started this movie, he said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to end up being a good director. I don't know if I'm going to get it right, but I know I'm going to get Boston right. And he's expressed how it was frustrating to him all these years watching movies that, you know, people just get up there and it's like, park your car and have a yard, you know, the whole kind of exaggeration of Boston. But he really wanted to show, a much more real side to it. So by casting locals, he also said, you know, it's going to be a bigger challenge for the actors in the film. You have to blend in. You have to assimilate with them.
You said that when you tried to, there was a moment when you tried to get onto the set and they wouldn't let you through on the street in Boston because they thought you were just a fan and that you were lying when you said that you were actually in the movie.
Yeah.
Does that mean that they didn't think you looked like a genuine movie star?
I think they thought I was genuine Dorchester, which was even better. I rarely get mistaken for a genuine movie star, but I prefer that. That's why I live in New York. Because I think once, too, you're a genuine movie star, then, you know, it's hard to hide away and become other people. Certainly movie stars like Sean Penn can do it, Meryl Streep can do it. But I'm wary of being too glossied, because then, you don't get to play the real people, and that's what I find most fascinating.
I was so delighted to see you in The Office, to see you in a comedy, because I hadn't seen you in a comedy before that, and you do it so well. I want you to describe your character, Holly, in The Office.
Holly Flax was the new head of human resource at Dunder Mifflin, and quite serious about her job, and shortly finds a comrade and kinship to Michael Scott, played by the great Steve Carell.
And, you know, Michael is such a clueless person. He gets everything wrong. He always thinks he's funny when he's really not. What makes it possible for your character to click so well with him?
I think Holly shares the same cornball sense of humor with Michael. You know, they're both, you know, he's more odd, but she's slightly odd. And, you know, I just like to say there's a lid for every pot.
Let's hear a scene from The Office with you and Steve Carell. And this is after you've left the Scranton branch for another branch. And then you and Michael meet again at a company picnic that's bringing together the employees from all the branches. But you show up with your new boyfriend. Nevertheless, you and Michael decide to write a sketch together to perform at the picnic. And the sketch is supposed to be a history of the paper company you work for, Dunder Mifflin. But you're doing it as a parody of Slumdog Millionaire. And for any of our listeners who haven't seen Slumdog Millionaire, it's a film set in India in which a young man from the slums ends up being a contestant on the Indian version of the quiz show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And when this young man keeps getting answers right in spite of his lack of education and he keeps winning more and more money, he's taken by the police who torture him to find out how he's managing to get the right answers. So here's you as Holly with Michael, played by Steve Carell, doing this the Slumdog Millionaire satire at the Dunder Mifflin picnic.
And now, presenting
Slum Dunder Mifflinaire. Are you ready to play Slum Dunder Mifflinaire?
Yes, I am.
For $100, where did Dunder meet Mifflin? A, on Easy Street. B, a tour of Dartmouth College. C, they never met. D, brushing their teeth.
Oh, I'm thinking. I'm going to say B, tour of Dartmouth College.
That is correct. How did you know that?
No! Oh! Ah! I was there! I was a tour guide at Dartmouth College. No!
Nice campus. Think you'll get in?
Yeah, I'm definitely getting in. I'm a shoo-in.
I'm Robert Dunder.
I'm Robert Mifflin.
Robert Mifflin had a great life, but unfortunately had undiagnosed depression, which over 9 million Americans suffer from and is very treatable. For $250, how did he kill himself? A, a rope. B, a knife. C, a gun. D, brushing his teeth.
$250 is more money than I've ever seen in my life. I will say C, a gun. He shot himself in the head.
That is correct!
Yes!
That is so funny. You know, the children at the picnic are horrified, and actually
horrified.
Everyone is kind of horrified as they hear you doing this like awful routine, tasteless routine.
And the thing is, they thought, I mean, that's what I love about those characters. They think they're killing it. They're just, you know.
I know. You can't wipe the smile off your face. You are enjoying this so much. You think it's so funny.
They're wonderful. And you know, but it's when we... Obviously, Steve and I knew that was the joke, you know, that they bomb. But when we had to get up and perform it, and obviously everyone else is directed not to laugh and look horrified, there's a part of you as an actor, you're still standing on a stage, however makeshift, in the middle of a park, and you're not getting a reaction. You start like breaking out into a cold sweat, like trying to get a laugh, trying to make them like you. But we and every time we had to redo it, we're like, oh my God, I don't think I can go back out there. You know? But it was a good laugh.
So did you write any of the lines yourself?
Not in that scene, I don't think. I remember... The part, obviously, what the listeners won't be able to see is the visual of that scene is as we're torturing, I get to torture Steve. I started pulling out his fingernails with my teeth. That was one form of torture. I was very chuffed with myself for coming up with that. But you know, The Office is pretty tightly scripted, and it's not until the third or fourth time through a take that they let you play around. Well, certainly Steve, and I wait and I take his lead. If he starts going off course, then I'll follow him if I can keep up.
How did you get the part in The Office?
You know, The Wire actually led to The Office, funny enough. All the writers on The Office are all huge fans of The Wire, and it was really just also that, and there's part coincidence that right after the Oscars, I knew the next choice I made would have to be a good one. And I was also well aware that all the offers I was about to get would be of, you know, parts of single drug-addicted mothers. It's what was on people's minds. And so I wanted to keep a couple of steps ahead of people.
Because that's what you played in Gone Baby Gone, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so I thought, well, what would surprise people? One would be a comedy, and two would be if I put on a skirt and brushed my hair. I thought that would work well. So I had mentioned that to my agent, and he had called over to the office just to see if there was anything coming up that I might be right for. And they coincidentally had been thinking of me because they were familiar with The Wire.
So I'd like to hear more about you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Queens. I grew up in Flushing, Queens, in the house my father grew up in. I
have really?
Two older sisters. Mm-hmm. It was very neighborhood. My grandmother and grandfather lived five blocks away.
What was the neighborhood like? What was the ethnic makeup?
It was mixed. It was Jewish families, Chinese families. There was a Korean family at the top of the block. My family, which was Polish and Irish and English, we were kind of a mix, mutt of it all. And, it was very much, I like to say, Archie Bunker, but with a driveway. We had, you know, house, driveway. We could play kickball in the street. Every 5 minutes or so, we'd have to stop because a car came down the block. But it was a fun neighborhood to grow up in, and we still... You know, you can be a kid, but yet we still had access to Manhattan, which my parents, they took us to the city as much as possible. And I think that's what got me interested in theater, was just as we stood in line at TKTS whenever we could.
Well, you went to the High School of Performing Arts.
So I did, yeah.
How did that compare to either the movie or TV version of Fame?
It actually compares, it's pretty similar to the original film. It's nothing like the TV series, and I didn't see the remake of Fame that just came out last year, so I can't speak of that. But it was quite a magical place. You know, for me, coming from Queens, where, you know, my school friends I'd known since kindergarten, and then I guess I was 14 years old when I went in for sophomore year or so, I'm surrounded by a bunch of really creative kids and from all economic backgrounds and all five boroughs of the city. And it was a real eye-opener. It was great. It was a small, and the building used to be on 46th Street, and it was this tiny little conservatory, and you would be in history class, but you can hear chamber music echoing through the halls. Or I remember one day actually being bored in history class, daydreaming out, you know, looking out the window, or rather the door frame. And this dancer walked by, and he caught my eye, and he kept walking. But then he came back, and he did this huge leap, probably like 6 feet in the air, or so it seemed to me. And no one else saw. It was just this moment, this dancer flying by, and I just thought, I can't believe this is high school. it was a beautiful place. And also, you know, to have training in theater and not put my parents in debt. You know, it's a school. It's a New York City public high school, so it was free.
So when you were in the High School of Performing Arts studying acting, how important was being pretty? Because being pretty is pretty highly prized in high school, period. But also in acting, being pretty or handsome is very highly prized if you want leading man and leading lady kind of roles.
Yeah, you know, I did not see any of that within my class. Unless I was naive, but I don't remember kids being body conscious or, you know, beauty conscious. We were really all about the work. We were so immersed in that world. And, you know, we would study Stanislavski's The Method. So we took ourselves very seriously. and it wasn't about having the right hair and clothing and, you know. Although, you know, we did know who the pretty people were. And, you know, that was Jennifer Aniston was one of those people.
Was she in your class?
She was a year younger than me. Yeah. Huh. And so we, you know, You know who they are then. She had great hair then. it was all a pretty tight-knit group of kids.
So this was in the 80s, right, that you would have been in high school?
Yeah.
So what were some of the touchstone movies and shows for you then?
Well, upon graduation, you know, my first job, I did Biloxi Blues. I did this touring production of Biloxi Blues. And there was an actor I worked with on that called Andrew Polk, and who really was like a big brother to me. And he took me to see a bunch of movies that were, which would later influence me. The first one was Down by Law, the Jim Jarmusch movie.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I suddenly started loving the world of Mike Leigh and all these regular people. I think that's where that influence came from. And the first movie I saw of his was High Hopes. That was the big influence.
Did you have stage fright then? Because the shows that you'd done had basically been in high school, and suddenly you were touring around the country.
I didn't have stage fright then. I was way too young to even think of it. I had a bit of stage fright during the final week of Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway, and I think it was just out of pure exhaustion, and that play is really takes a toll on you physically and emotionally. And there was a moment where this is the opening scene, and we had a week to go, and I, for the first time ever, had this, I had this dialogue going on in my head where I just said, oh, I'm just so tired. I just want to sit down and cry. I just want to sit on the stage right here. And at the same time, miraculously, these lines are coming out. Blanche, oh, you know, that whole first scene when Blanche and Stella are, you know, reunited, and it's joyous. And my body, I actually got a little scared because my body started to, you know, probably lost 3 inches in height because I started to go down. And I was a little afraid to go back onto the next scene. But actually, it was Natasha Richardson who I was playing that version of Streetcar with. And she just gave me a big hug and said, right, back out we go, you know, and set me on the right course.
So, you know, in talking about Streetcar, what were the difficulties of playing Stella? Streetcar is such a sexual play. I mean, so much of the text and the subtext is all about sex.
Oh, yeah. I had the great fortune of doing this play twice. The first time I got to do it down at the Kennedy Center with Patricia Clarkson as Blanche, directed by Gary Hines. And Patty actually found old letters that Tennessee Williams had written that said, I'm writing a new play. It's about two sisters. And I think often, you know, because of the, you know, obviously Marlon Brando made such an impression on Stanley and the Blanche, that play usually finds two stars to play those roles, and it outshines Stella. But we brought it back to the triangle. And if Blanche and Stanley aren't fighting over Stella, I feel like productions really miss out a huge point of that play.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Stella, her, you know, Tennessee's description of Stella is that she's lying in bed reading movie magazines, eating chocolates with her painted fingernails, and she's waiting in bed for her husband to come home. And that's the first part of Streetcar Named Desire, her desire. You know, it's more famously, you know, gets into Blanche and Stanley's relationship. But it starts, I mean, that's why she's with him, you know. She doesn't have any more money. They came from money, but she doesn't have any more. Stanley doesn't have any more. They come from different, you know, class, you know, backgrounds. So why else would these two people be together? And that's just because they're mad for each other. They can't keep their hands off each other.
Amy Ryan, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you too, Terry. I appreciate it.
Amy Ryan co-stars in the new thriller Green Zone, which opens tomorrow. Since she was in two TV series we love, The Office and The Wire, we've put links to all of our interviews with people from those shows on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also see clips from her new film. Actor Tom Hanks and director Steven Spielberg teamed up to tell the story of World War II in Europe with the HBO series Band of Brothers. 9 years later, they're back to tell another part of the war's story. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
The Pacific, a 10-part historical miniseries beginning Sunday night on HBO, opens the week after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. This saves a lot on production costs, but I'm guessing money wasn't the issue here. The Pacific has a budget of some $250 million. Those are Avatar numbers. And it's more than twice what HBO spent for its 2001 companion piece, Band of Brothers. This sudden entry into the drama, like the country's sudden entry into the war, throws us headlong into an unfamiliar world against an unfamiliar foe, confronting terrain and tactics that are completely unlike the more familiar and regimented battlefields of Europe. At the start of the miniseries, a new group of Marine recruits attend a briefing by a lieutenant colonel played by William Sadler. He's standing in front of a giant map of the Pacific, and he's telling his men what to expect once they arrive there. At the same time, he's telling us, too.
The Japanese are in the process of taking half of the world, and they mean to keep it. The death from the air, land, and sea. Here is what the Japs are not expecting. The United States Marine Corps. Now, never mind Europe. The Nazis, Mussolini, Hitler is not going to be our job. Not until they can't whip them without us. The Pacific will be our theater of war. The Marines will do battle with the Japs on tiny specks of turf that we have never heard of. You, non-commissioned officers, you are the sinew and the muscle of the Corps. The orders come from the brass, and you get it done. And whenever this war is over, when we have swept upon the main islands of Japan and destroyed every scrap of that empire, the strategy will have been that of others. The victory will have been won by you.
Each installment of the Pacific opens with a long shot of that map, with the camera pulling in tightly to identify the location of the coming conflict. Almost always, the camera ignores the major landmasses and the familiar countries and coastlines, and hones in on an island speck so small, so seemingly insignificant, it's almost comic. Except that once the Marines land on those islands, it's all they know and all there is. And according to these unflinching battle recreations, there's no escape, little reason, and the difference between life and death seems utterly random. It's impossible to look at that random violence, the unusual landscapes, and the elusive enemies in the Pacific, and not draw parallels to, say, Afghanistan. As in Band of Brothers and Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, battles aren't depicted from a distant, comprehensible perspective. Like the camera honing in on a fly speck on a Pacific map, this miniseries zeroes in on a few key fact-based characters and shows us things from their perspective. And from their perspective, every confrontation is filled with adrenaline and confusion, loyalty and fear. Even the tedium is tense, because the quiet can be shattered at any time by sniper fire and explosions. And many times, it is. So many writers and directors collaborated on the Pacific, it's unwieldy to credit them individually. But the drama's three central actors, all based on Marines who wrote acclaimed accounts of their tours overseas, deserves special mention. James Badge Dale plays PFC Robert Leckie, who dreams of being a war correspondent. Joe Mazzello plays PFC Eugene Sledge, who arrives late to the Pacific conflict but quickly makes up for lost time. And Joe Seda plays John Bassalone, whose actions in the Pacific get him promoted, then reassigned, but that's hardly the end of his story. Seda, one of the talented stars of Homicide: Life on the Street, seems to have gotten younger somehow. And his portrayal of a kid who grows up quickly under fire is unforgettable. But there are moments in this drama that are unforgettable, too. One of them, one gruesome one that I'll never be able to shake, occurs about 6 hours into the miniseries. The Marines have overtaken a Japanese bunker, and in the aftermath of battle, they're sitting around in the same bunker as a dead Japanese machine gunner. That Japanese soldier, still in a firing position, has half of his skull shorn off. Where his brain used to be, there's now just an empty bowl filled with a mixture of blood and rain. It's a horrible visual. What makes it even worse is that one of the Marines, sitting at a higher elevation, is amusing himself by tossing pebbles into the dead soldier's open skull. Some fellow Marines look on in disgust. Others don't even look up. What has war done to these young men? That's the question this miniseries, even more than Band of Brothers, insists upon asking over and over. 1 hour is spent largely at a naval hospital, with one soldier under psychiatric observation. Other episodes, when the narrative finds a way to take its characters to cities in Australia or back in the States, suggest that everything about those civilized settings, from the colors and the sounds to the comfort and the women, is a world apart from their harrowing wartime experience. The intensely frantic battle sequences in the Pacific underscore the fact that war is hell. But an equally resonant message of this excellent new World War II miniseries is that returning from war and bringing its memories with you can be hell, too.
David Bianculli writes TVWorthWatching.com and is the author of the new book, Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. He reviewed The Pacific, which premieres Sunday on HBO. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.